Blog Talk Radio.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Show started. Welcome to Poet Runner. And I have Richard Modiano, our host, our co-host, and Mark will be calling in a moment. And who is our guest today, Richard?
Mark Ziggins will be, we'll have him on the line pretty soon.
You want to talk a little bit about him? Because I think he's looking for the call-in number because he was doing a writing project and he got caught up in it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there he is.
Woohoo! Here he is.
Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Hi, Raphael?
Yep. Yeah. And Richard, too.
Hi, yeah, Richard. Oh, great. All right, well, so we are going to be talking to Mark Ziggins about his new poetry book, Lion Street, his seventh collection from Bamboo Dart Press. We'll go back to ordering information at the end of the conversation, but my first question for you, Mark, is how did this book come together?
It's a great question, Richard. It came together over a number of years. I came of age in San Francisco at a crucial transition point in the life of the city between the late 70s and the early 80s. And when I was coming of age there, it was a city that was sort of gentle, bright, still had some remnants of the hippie era in place, was highly creative, friendly, democratic, and it had a tremendous sense of prospect. And in a very short period of time thereafter, we saw the murder of Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk. We had the coming of AIDS, which devastated the city. There was a shift in the country and in the state of California to a much colder, crueler kind of conservative politics. And along with that, the tech boom in San Francisco really began to take off in a way that had been hitherto unimagined. So the city changed quite radically, and there was something very rare and special about the city at that time that I wanted to capture in poems and to relate to how the city has changed and how in the ensuing years I've changed since.
So did you, are the poems in the collection, did you have a plan for these poems? Or were they poems that you wrote and then you said, hey, I could put these together in the way that you just described?
They were poems that I started writing organically years and years ago. And then a while back, a dear friend of mine, Aaron Cressida Wilson, who's a screenwriter, said to me, Mark, you really should gather these San Francisco poems and make a book of them. And I began to think that that was a good idea, continued to write poems, but over a period of time got a vision for what the book might be, how the poems might relate to each other, and then bit by bit began culling the poems from the larger set, editing them, shaping them, and crystallizing them into something that functioned as a coherent collection, and I think more broadly as a coherent art piece.
Well, it all works together beautifully, Mark. The sequence of poems, they all fit in. I mean, it really worked out well. So I congratulate you on that. And clearly it was the whole book from its original inception as scattered poems about San Francisco down to its final form is a labor of love. And you can feel that love for the city of San Francisco and for the, well, a sort of, I don't want to say love, but more than nostalgia even, something stronger than that for that particular time. And by the way, I came across the breakdown of the word nostalgia, which is nosotros and alja, which means the pain of returning home. So there is a bit of that in there.
Yes, I think there is. If you think about nostalgia in that term, I think that's correct. There is a bit of the pain of returning home and looking at what that home has become. We tend in our culture to think about nostalgia as something wistful, a wistful looking back, and I don't think that's accurate. One person who read the collection while it was in manuscript form before we began to put it together in its published form described it as testimony, and I thought that was a good description for the backward-looking parts of the book. I think what it also does is it aims to capture the spirit and the quality of life of that time and to invite readers and to invite the city to think about how, without repeating the particulars, do we bring that kind of creative energy and freedom, warmth, and love back into the life of this city, which has become a much more scarred, crueler, and regimented place.
Yeah, well, one of the poems in the book that sort of epitomizes what you are doing here is the poem Solstice. And I wonder if you could read that for us.
Sure, I'd be more than happy to. Let me just grab it. So this is Solstice, and it is set at a place that was originally called Major Ponds Traveling Chautauqua and went through several variations after the Majors was gone. It became a jazz club that served Ethiopian food, and then a place called Solstice. And it goes like this. I watched back 20 years tonight, sitting on a suede barrel stool at Solstice, drinking soda water in the place, once Major Ponds Traveling Chautauqua, full of funky Victorian couches and pitted floorboards, where double whiskeys flew down my throat, poured sloppy, and delivered free by the waitress who called my name, me too blind to see. I watched back 20 years as I stared past the too fine and once slick decor, the ethereal quasi-musicians playing their astral grind, to when the Majors was a blues joint with a whorehouse upright piano and same said waitress used to let me tonk up the place on weeknights when the band was off. I watched back 20 years as I looked at the well-dressed folk sitting in the candlelit booths by the window where Rasselas jazz hopped and bopped, and before then just the dusty sounds of creaky night music at the Majors. I watched back 20 years drinking soda water thinking, how do I gentle this old body that I rode so hard? Can I freshen that up? Said the chunky young man behind the overpolished bar. Huh? Can I put some soda water on top of that ice and lime you've got there? No thanks. I watched back 20 years, chewing ice, missing the rough, scuffed bar, its pits and its dents, the scuffed and broken tables, random thrift store chairs, torn red couch velvet, and my sweet black-topped waitress, who emptied the owner's pockets into my glass, standing me to round after round on those, for her, empty nights. I watched back 20 years, slid from my stool, swept round the joint the long way as I made for its still-bowed door, and smiled, knowing that we had changed places, Solstice and I. She was clean and bright and slick and new, and I'd become the trusty old rough and scuffed place of my youth, carrying now with me what once I needed place to establish.
Well, that's a beautiful poem, Mark, and I like how the reverie is interrupted when the barkeep says, can I freshen that up? And that is like, that shows how really carefully constructed this poem was to me. Because it is like, it's like we're sort of like in two dimensions at the same time. Your reverie in the present and the reverie being broken that way, and then we come back to the present, and then the remaining two stanzas, it all fits together so wonderfully, I thought.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And yes, that's sort of what I wanted to do in that poem, was to set it in the present, put the narrator, the fictive I in that, in the present, looking back and feeling it, and then have this moment where he's shocked back into the present, and he realizes he's not in that place that he loved, that was a home away from home, if you will. It's this place where he really doesn't fit. The city's changed. He's not a part of that. But the thing that gives him his reverie is now something that he carries with him wherever he goes.
Yes, and I think that is in that final stanza, those final lines. She was clean and bright and slick and new, and I'd become the trusty old rough and scuffed place of my youth. So that is just, that was really a fine way of bringing this poem together. I mean, I love that. And by the way, we're not talking about just a movement through time. We're talking about a movement through space in this book as well. Because one of the really interesting things about it is there is a map of San Francisco that numbers all of the locations that are visited in the poems. And for readers, and I do really recommend you, that when you buy this book, or if you already have the book, do look at that map and pull up on your computer, on your search engine, the places that are referenced. And it's worth researching. I mean, it's one of the things about a really good book of poetry like this one is you want to get into it and you want to explore it in and out. And this is the kind of book, it's short enough so that you can spend a lot of time with it and really get into it. And that was one of the things that I enjoyed about Lion Street, is this entree into not just what the poet has written, but you know, you can see the material spaces that gave rise to the poems, that's another thing that I really liked about the book. And was that your idea to include the map, Mark? Or
it's a good question. It was actually the idea of a sculptor friend of mine named Noah James Saunders, who parenthetically made three absolutely stunning wire sculptures inspired by poems in the book that then became the centerpiece of videos over my reading several of the poems. But Noah read a draft of this just before it went to the publisher, and he said, you know, Mark, this really needs a map. And we got on the phone and talked about it a little bit. And he said, you know, these places are so evocative, these names are so evocative, but for people who want to read this book outside of San Francisco, they need to have a way of attaching those names to specific locations to make them real, to see how things cluster. And I thought he was absolutely right. So then the question for me was, how do I set about making a map that fits the book well, that amplifies what I'm trying to accomplish there and gives people a different way of engaging? And the premise that I had was, if we could make a map that was like a poem concrete, that it was a concrete visualized poem that moved, didn't simply sit there in a static fashion, that then we'd really have something. And so I had the good fortune to work with a woman named Lark Simmons, who's a wonderful graphic designer. And we went through map after map until we found one that could kind of work. And then we added color to it. And if you look at it, you'll notice that in the bay, there are ripples of waves. And that was added. So we added detail to it to create a sense of motion. And then we designed the pins in the pin map specifically in terms of their shape, their color, their numbering, to create a sense of movement so that, as one friend described it after she saw it, it feels like a walking tour of our youth. And that was the aim with the map. What we did to make that even more powerful was we introduced a table of locations with the pin numbers of the map and references to the pages of the poems in the book. And I spent days on that table figuring out how to do it in a way where you read down those venue names and you read down those streets, and it's like you're reading a poem there. It's not simply a listing or an index.
Well, it was definitely worth all of the effort you put into that. I mean, it really... it makes the book unique for me. It's it's really one of the, it's a kind of an immersive collection, and those are the kind of collections that, you know, that I like, that, you know, I personally like. I mean, other people, you can dip into it at different points, sure, but for me, going through it from start to finish and then going back over it again and looking up all of these places, and some of which I remember, although I didn't live in San Francisco, I had friends in San Francisco in who lived there in the 70s and 80s, and some still do. And I was living in New York City at the time, and I used to take the Greyhound bus from New York to San Francisco back in the 1970s and 80s. And I stayed with my friends, and I recall these sort of gaps. It was actually a yearly trip for me because I was working at the Art Students League. And during the summer, like most schools, they had a reduced, they basically closed for several weeks. So I had like a 3-week vacation period, and I would go back to San Francisco for that and then down to Los Angeles to see family and then back to New York. But I do remember a lot of these places, and I remember friends taking me to some of the clubs. And one of the poems along those lines that maybe you could read for us is Punk Poets Too Fucked to Drink.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Brief note about that poem. The title is a reversal of the title of a single that the Dead Kennedys put out,
yeah.
I think probably around 1980, something like that, called Too Drunk to Fuck. And
yeah.
The poem is written as an answer to Howl. And what I had in mind when I did it was something very, very particular and specific. When Ginsberg wrote Howl, it was a countercultural cry, but it was decidedly within the context and history of modernism. It was a manifesto of a very particular and personal kind, but it operated as a manifesto. And when I came of age during the era of punk rock, we had already encountered in a deep way postmodernism. There was a sense of no future, of the destruction of history. You know, we were called the blank generation. And so the question of how do we respond to what we see going on around us, and also this sharp turn back to an even more odious form of conservatism than we saw in the 1950s, how do we respond to that from a punk perspective? What's our Howl now? And so this poem answers Ginsberg and speaks to what our truth was. It comes in three parts. The first one is set at the Mabuhay Gardens, metaphorically, which was the main punk club in San Francisco at the time.
Known as the Fab Mab, as I recall.
That's right. Known as the Fab Mab, exactly. And it was a Filipino restaurant that got converted into a music venue and became the place where a guy named Dirk Dirksen, who was related to the Senator Everett Dirksen, really presided over the punk movement in San Francisco. So the first part of the poem is about that and sets the political pace. The second part is a very compressed poem, which talks about a shift possibly in the way we think about poetry from Whitman, who was the poet whose long lines informed Howl, to William Carlos Williams, who created these very compressed double spondaic poems and was the writer of the foreword to the original edition of Howl that City Lights published. And then the third part is an answer. So it's a three-part poem, and each one has a very different kind of sound, style, focus, and pace. And here it goes. At round end of No Corner Bar, me and Ripper backs to stage, grab filthy glasses and plastic Polynesia, tilt bottom shelf, exhale and converse behind a shirtless gobbed and maggot wriggle. Jello admonishes black and stinking pogo crowd to be Republican, never thinking that 1 year hence, kill the poor will find happy embrace in red states, more scared of welfare than war, and tuck sunny Ron in Washington, where healthy school lunch is 6 french fries and ketchup, not rotting, is a vegetable. I remember the cop cars burning that Dan White night, but more I remember the sidewalk outside Twin Peaks, corner of Market, home to freaks, long before San Francisco urban chic, and ENG, new to me, pushing and shoving, starting a riot. That's the story never told about that San Francisco. But I saw the news crew spiking rage as Spilt Milk, mayor of Castro, and decentered Moscone were shoved aside, TV slap at Gay Pride, and Twinkie excuse, colonel of conservative human rights now running 30 years in low-tax CA, waiting for the day when limited government would metastasize. Short ice has become short lines, frictionless. The times demand Williams, not Whitman. A pressure, constant, hard, clash, words, short, text, words, unvowel, no space for air. Fuck you. The times demand Williams, not Whitman. Shall we give way? Capitulate, or do it early. The times demand Williams, not Whitman. Spondy on spondy, consonant diamonds, bent light, facet play, a flash. The times demand Williams, not Whitman. Is it our time now to surrender long lines, to howl no more, clicking faster, clicking faster, clicking faster, till letters are too much information to see, till we pixel-click our way in a vaster, faster space of small screens, isolated but accessible? Is it our work now to surrender long lines, to turn the dirt on Alan's grave, to give less and less and less and send more and more and more and more? Is it time to drop the analog growl of John Lee singing, boom, 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 howl, 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 a different kind of howl, a wolf moaning at midnight? Is it time to gape that mouth, to muzzle the grit, to join the raft of bits? Is it time? Is it time? Is it time? Is this any more a question? Can time demand? Can there be a moment on a virtual raft? A moment. Not moments, not any moment. A moment. A moment to move, time justified. No, howls the clown prince in a world without foundation. Not even time, not even these times, not even this moment can announce anything. The times don't give us an historical curl. We cannot surf any more to shore on the times. This time, it is on us. The times demand nothing, but what will we demand of ourselves?
Yes, this is another terrifically constructed poem, Mark. It's like, how did you put this poem together, if I may ask?
This was one of the rare poems where I began with the architecture and then worked into it. I wanted to make it a three-part poem. I wanted it to have a development and an evolution. And when I thought about how do I want to set this up as a punk poem and speak to what punk rock was saying politically, I remembered in kind of a flash this evening when I'd gone down to the Mabuhay Gardens with a young woman to see the Dead Kennedys play, and I ran into a guy named Ron Greco, whose name in the punk band Crime was Ripper, and he was standing at the bar kind of hanging out, and I went over and chatted with him, and we began kind of a long conversation about things, and meanwhile, Jello's doing his kind of political punk rock on stage, and he's wriggling around in a sweaty pair of pants and no shirt, which was kind of his common garb at the time. And I said, I have to start it there. And when I got that notion, then I said to myself, I'm going to set up the first two stanzas of the poem as a kind of structured answer to and response to the Dead Kennedys' first album, which was called Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables. And the back cover of it had a photograph of the cop cars burning the night that people rioted after the Dan White verdict. And so I began to put some lines in that related to the album. For instance, I have the line about ketchup not rotting, it is a vegetable, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so there are these sort of little allusions to the punk scene and punk rock, and that gave the basic structure for the first part. And the remainder was just kind of a tightly structured, loosely metered political development. Then the second part was about very consciously asking the question about, in American poetry, do we want and need short lines? Is that what's necessary now, just as Ginsberg felt that the way to break the lock of iambic pentameter on academic poetry in the 50s was to return to Whitman's long lines? And I did, and even though I'm an enormous Williams fan, I decisively answered no. And the reason is because we were no longer in a modern age, and the compression of language that we saw through our immersion in the internet was doing horrible things to our humanity. And so the third part is a very, very sharp answer to that. And what I did there was I consciously constructed that as kind of a highly rhythmic with stream of consciousness flow, as opposed to the shorter, more conventionally defined poetic lines in parts one and two. And then the last piece was, I wanted to ground this philosophically. So in the final stanza, there's a long no shouted by someone called the Clown Prince. And the Clown Prince was the nickname that had been given to the philosopher turned cultural critic Richard Rorty, who tried to introduce the notion of a strong liberal valued pragmatism, which he argued could only be developed by strong poetry. And so I bring Rorty into the final stanza as a way of looking at what we, without a historical foundation and without a justification outside ourselves, need to do if we want to bring some humanity back to the city and back to the world.
Well, the poem works on all of the classical, well, not really classical, but I think it was Pound that came up with this taxonomy of the music, the images, and the ideas. And they're all three working. I mean, ideally, the music carries the images which embody the ideas. And I saw this poem working in exactly that way, hitting on all three of those. Some poems are strong in image, they're weak in music. Some have powerful ideas, and they're weak in a couple of other areas. But this poem, for me, hit on all three. And that's why I was so impressed by it, and that's why I wanted you to read that one. So.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate that. It's worth mentioning that as a poet, I tend to think and operate sonically, and I see things in musical terms. And so my poems, even though there's intellectual content to them and careful attention to the craft of words on the page, they always begin in sound.
And that, I think, is what makes them fresh, I think. That idea, the fact that they do begin in sound, and although they are carefully worked, they are carefully constructed, nonetheless, they do, because of that, because they are based on that sound, they come out fresh. They come out vivid and alive when you read them. And I know that one of the bad things about workshops is you can workshop a poem to death. You can go over it so many times that you take out its vitality, and it might have a nice, perfect, it might be perfection by a certain standard of poetry or on the surface, but there is something missing in it. And the fact that you do begin with sound, I think, is what is the energy that carries your poetry for me.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very important to me, and it's interesting when you talk about workshops, because when I occasionally have taught workshops, one of the things that I focus on is getting poets, especially those who haven't done much reading, to read their poems out loud while they're in development and see how they sound and see how they flow and what resonance points they bring forward in people's bodies and where they stumble on the words, and to think about how can you write this in a way so that when you speak it, it feels like you're communicating what you want to be giving to the audience. And when you read it on the page, that sound resonates with the reader. So they're not just reading words and getting concepts or conjuring images, that the poem becomes tactile and that it activates their sense of sound and smell as well.
And I think that, that's another point about your poetry, because it does bring in all of these senses. They're sensuous in this, in terms of there is texture, there is sight, there is sound, there is taste, there is odor working in these poems. And so in that respect, they are whole. They, I mean, one of the things that I think characterizes beat poetry is a recognition that emotion occurs in the body. The idea that when you are angry, your jaw clenches, your belly tightens. When you are happy, you relax, you become open, your body language changes. And I think that you were able to bring that into your poetry. So we're almost out of time, Mark, and I wonder if you could lay just one more poem on us before we finish up.
I'd be happy to. Is there one that you would like
me to
read?
I'll let you choose.
Well, given what you said about emotion and how it plays in the body, which is very true for me, I'm going to read a simpler, softer poem that's about loss and regret and how that plays in the body. It's called Unmasking. And it's a reverse sonnet form. It starts with a couplet and then has the two longer stanzas thereafter. It goes like this. On the third floor of the Drisco on Broderick and Pacific, your vintage French silk robe opened and fell with a resigned shrug, as if to say, I know, now is your time to go, but I'm here for the asking. I have nothing left to hide. And I could see in your watered eyes the history of Spain and the Sephardic marks of generations held under Murano's spell, your ironed black hair banding your breasts in stuttered light.
Well, I love that one, Mark. That's a perfect ending. Listeners, the book is Lion Street by Mark Zagans. It is from Bamboo Dart Press. You can order it directly from the publisher, which I recommend, because really small presses are the ones that are supporting poetry these days. And you will find all the risky cutting-edge work coming from a small press rather than from the big, well-known publishers, Viking, Penguin, etc. So it really, if you love poetry, if you love literature, buy it from the small press, buy it from the publisher, Bamboo Dart Press. Look it up, put that in your search engine. You will be able to find it. It's an excellent book. And Mark, thank you for your time. Thank you for talking to us, and thank you for sharing your insights and your wonderful poetry.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Really appreciate it.
That's another episode of Poet Runner. Thank you for listening.